From the Sky News Centre at 5, Jimmy Savile's friend and chauffeur Ray Terrett has been found guilty of 7 rapes and 11 indecent assaults against girls. Claire Gregory reports.
His friend was wondering basically how my husband was been allowed to be touched all over the stomach, but it was all tactics. But he also felt that, and so did the police, that possibly he had some hypnotic field over him.
Two friends from Birmingham have both been sentenced to almost 13 years in prison after they travelled to Syria to join an Al-Qaeda-linked group. They were arrested on terror charges when they came back to the UK. In football, Mario Balotelli has been charged by the Football Association in relation to a recent posting on social media. He retweeted what he believed was an anti-racist cartoon, but it actually contained comments particularly offensive to black and Jewish people. NASA's Orion spacecraft, which is designed to one day fly astronauts to Mars, has completed a flawless test flight around the Earth. It came down in one piece in the Pacific Ocean, much to the delight of mission control.
We have splashdown. Splashdown confirmed at 10:29 a.m. Central Time. Orion is back on Earth. America has driven a golden spike as it crosses a bridge into the future.
Rail fares in Britain will go up by an average of 2.2% in January. Industry body, the Rail Delivery Group, says it's the lowest rise in ticket prices for 5 years. Sam Smith is leading this year's nominations at the Grammys. He appears in 3 categories, including Best Pop Album, alongside Ed Sheeran, Miley Cyrus, Ariana Grande, Katy Perry and Coldplay. More nominations will be announced later. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Windmill Hill, Sam Mungan. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, who are the local organisations behind the TTIP treaty, which threatens to enable banks and big businesses to sue elected governments? Our elected governments, if they introduce a law they don't like. Is it the same that were behind the push for our elected mayor? And 70 years ago, World War II was drawing to a close. We revisit the so-called death of Adolf Hitler and his treasurer, Martin Bormann. How do we know what we think we know? As the Russian TV network NTV prepare to look again at an era where Stalin was accusing the West of hiding some of the top Nazis. And the US academic Noam Chomsky, linguist and anarchist, was in London last week talking about how the hopes of the post-war world have been slowly crushed. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 2 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 9 Celsius. Well, not very high, is it? Sunny spells on Saturday, cloudy and possibly wintry showers on Sunday. So get out tomorrow if you possibly can. Next week, highs of 6 Celsius, sunny spells, fog in the mornings and wet and windy weather too. So it doesn't sound quite so grey as it was most of the week this week. Next weekend, 13th and 14th of December, highs of 5 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Windmill Hill, Sam Mungan. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Sam, you're quite a new councillor, aren't you? I think you arrived in May this year.
I did indeed.
Tell us what got you interested in politics and what kind of world you come from.
Well, I mean, I've always been interested in politics. It's probably the family I grew up with, really. I describe being the Labour Party as part of my DNA. My dad worked for the council in education. My mum worked for the NHS. My dad came from a northern Yorkshire town, Goole, which was famous for its shipping in the last century. and all the issues that affect those people, either receiving council services, NHS services, living in places like Gaul. Really, I was brought up with those issues at the dining room table, you know, debating politics, why it's important.
Doesn't sound like much of a debate, since both of your parents were quite left-wing and working in public service. I mean, a lot of people nowadays would say, particularly, you know, a Conservative Party, possibly even the Lib Dems too, would say, well, actually, you had it very, very easy. Families like that, families in the public sector, were cushioned from the real world by a kind of nanny state. Now, those days are over.
Well, not in the era that I grew up. You know, I grew up in the 1980s and 1990s, when those public sector services were being attacked by the Thatcher government and the major government after it, when schools, weren't refurbished, when NHS services were underfunded and we had waiting lists that were 18 months long. Anyone working in those services during that time were under real pressure.
Okay, so what about now? What are you actually up to on the City Council? What committees are you on? And have you found your first few months in the job?
I've really enjoyed it. It's been a fascinating experience and a really steep learning curve.
But hang on a minute, because apparently the mayor is the dictator. He decides everything. So what's the point? You know, you're saying it's been fascinating, but you haven't really got a lot of power, have you?
Well, we don't have a lot of direct power in terms of decision-making at the council, but I think there's two really key roles for local councillors. The first one is in terms of scrutiny, and I'm lucky to sit on our overview scrutiny committee, which oversees all of our scrutiny commissions. So I really get to see sort of the council from a strategic point of view, all the important decisions that are happening, and really hold the mayor to task for his decisions around that. And then as a local councillor, you know, in terms of influencing what's going on in the ward, representing local people and opinions, you know, the mayor can't, as elected mayor, represent all the people in Bristol. And that's why it's important to have councillors telling him what's actually happening out there and how the cuts he's making to services are really affecting individuals' lives.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to listen, does he?
He doesn't have to listen, but that's why we need councillors to try and make him listen. Obviously, it would be better if we had, a Labour mayor who could listen to us as a colleague, but we don't have that. But hopefully after 2016 we will.
What about calling him to account? I mean, you're saying you're calling him to account, but actually at the end of the day, he doesn't really have to take any notice of what you've got to say at all. You're doing the scrutiny job, but you can't actually change any decisions.
I mean, I'll be honest, you know, a lot of the time he doesn't listen to us, but we can show actually that we've had a real influence in terms of some of his thinking. For instance, the living wage, Labour has campaigned really hard to get that introduced to the council, and we had to really convince the mayor that was the right way to go, and we've managed to do that now. We've got living wage for council employees.
Well, what's the difference between that and the minimum wage? Sorry to interrupt you, but you know, this is, there's all sorts, everyone knows wages aren't high enough, yeah. Right? There's the minimum wage, the living wage. What do they mean?
So the living wage is based on what it takes for an individual to be able to afford to live in the society we live in terms of the costs for housing, food, transport, all of those things.
So why isn't that the same as the minimum wage? Yeah,
I mean, well, personally, it should be. The Labour Party have pledged to increase the minimum wage if it gets into power next year. I'd like to see them go further than that and actually come up with a timetable for making the minimum wage in line with the living wage. And that's what I'd like to see happening nationally. But we've got to start locally and actually say that the council's taken a stance to say we'll give our employees living wage. I'd like to see that go into our contracts for things like the arena that's going to be built in the next few years, and also really leads from all the other organisations in Bristol and make sure that people like our NHS services, our major employers are also becoming living wage employers.
Well, the minimum wage also is only per hour, isn't it? So you might only have a couple of hours of work per week at minimum wage. Of course, that's not enough to live on, and you're going to need benefits for many people, even close to around about, maybe even just above the minimum wage, they still need to be claiming benefits.
That's absolutely right. You know, the vast majority of the benefits we pay in this country are for working people. We have to subsidise the low wages that apparently we need to keep our economy growing. I actually would like to see people paid more than that. I mean, we do have working tax credits to increase that the money that people are getting in their pockets, but those are being attacked as well at the moment. So we need our employers to do more and support well-paid jobs, not just minimum wage jobs.
Now, you're talking about the arena there. When it gets built, I thought it was still up in the air as to whether it's actually going to happen or not, because there's so many questions about how the city's going to pay for this down the line.
Well, as you probably know, there was agreement this week at Cabinet in terms of an operator being identified, and that will bring a big chunk of the budget in to pay for the arena in terms of the lease that they'll be paying on a yearly basis. We'd like to see more information in terms of how it will be paid for, and I suppose the risk particularly that the Bristol City Council will be holding on that. I personally think building the arena is a positive thing for the city, overall be a good thing, but Labour Party has said we don't want to see it at any cost, so we need more information about whether actually it's affordable and sustainable and where that risk sits.
Well, surely how have we come this far down the line without knowing whether we can afford it or not?
Well, we know how much it's going to cost, and there's projections in terms of the income it go in, I suppose.
Okay, can you give us the latest update? Because it started off, I think, as at 90 million, and now it's 110 or 120 million. What's the latest figure?
I don't think it's quite that high. I think it's around 90 to 100 million. There's different bits involved. In terms of the build, I think it's around 90 million. There's other bits that go into it in terms of developing the site. The particular bit that I'd like to see that we haven't seen any budget for so far is a transport plan. How are we going to get people to and from the arena? Are we going to have extra bus facilities, trains? You know, what's the parking going to look like? And what the contribution will be from the operator and the builder into that?
And what about, for example, the poorest quarter of the city, people who just don't have the money to buy a, whatever, 30, 40, 50, 60, £100 ticket to go to the arena to some event? They're saying, well, this is just a vanity project.
Well, you know, again, personally, I don't believe it's a vanity project. It's well before the mayor. The mayor's going to take, a large amount of the credit for building this, but actually, the plans have been in place for a while. I think overall it will benefit the city as a whole. I hope that the operators will come up with a pricing policy that will actually be open to all people in Bristol, and particularly, a programme of events that will be open to and exciting for the population as a whole as well.
Okay, so as someone who's on the scrutiny committee, give us an idea of, you must have done a bit of work on the arena, but what other things are you keeping your eyeballs on?
The other big thing we've been discussing the last month, as you won't be surprised, is green capital, which,
again, with the resignation of the guy that's supposed to be running it all.
Yeah, obviously, we're quite worrying, I suppose, as people.
Was he sacked? Did he resign or was he sacked?
You'd have to tell me, Tony.
I think he was sacked.
I've only seen what's in the press, and that's all. That's all we've had as councillors. He might, the official
really?
Line is he was.
So you have to find out through the press what's going on at the city council, even though you're a councillor. That's a pretty shocking thing to say. Are you sure about that?
Well, some of the times that's the case. I think, the scrutiny process gives us a lot of information, but sometimes, we hear when you hear. We'd like to see that better, and we try our best to hold the mayor to account.
That's a little bit like you hear at central government, don't you? The government itself likes to leak things to the press, not to talk to the House of Commons about it. Now, that sounds a little bit like kind of top-down. I mean, is that the sense you get from the mayor, that it's a little bit like he's deciding what's happening, and it's basically the job of councillors like you to scrutinise things afterwards, but you're basically dealing with a whole bunch of fait accomplis?
Well, I think there's certainly a large element to, George knows best into lots of things, and this will be good for you, so eat it up. But I think, like I said, that's the role for councillors, to actually give him the reality of what it's like. You can see that with things like things like parking zones, things like the rollout of 20 mile an hour zones, where people aren't getting it where they want it and people are getting it where they don't want it.
Okay, and also
the reality.
Also, what other things, as I said before, coming up at scrutiny, because this is a really important job you're doing on there.
Yeah, absolutely. So other thing that we've had, we're going into in the next few months, is budget scrutiny, which is a really important process. And actually, that's where councillors can have a big role, because we are the ones who ultimately have to sign off the budget for each year. We get to, that's probably one of the areas where we can influence, the mayor.
The annual budget, I think, you get to spend of our money is, which is quite nice, is 360 million, something like that. Is that about right?
That sounds about right to me. I mean, we obviously, it'd be nice if we got to decide where all of that went as councillors, but obviously, there are set things that we have to do as a council. That's statutory and passed down by central government.
What, like repair pavements, which isn't happening?
Well, I think that's one of the things that should be happening. So, if anyone's got anything that isn't being done, then
this is one of the things I've seen. I feel like I keep interrupting you a little bit too much here, but I mean, it's a bit of a bugbear of mine. I mean, for example, back in the day, the council would go around a lot of its facilities, our shared communal facilities in the city, like street lighting, pavements, this kind of thing, and they do fairly regular checks. Nowadays, it's just left to people to report it, and then if, say, a light, say, a, you know, in a particular part of a street street, a few of the lights out, or one street light is out, you can report it. And sometimes it can take weeks or even months for someone to come around and fix it. So, you know, that is your job. You're supposed to be keeping all that infrastructure up and running, and slowly but surely it seems to be falling apart.
Well, that is the job of the council, and that's what the mayor's responsible for. I see my job as a councillor in terms of, you know, raising that issues. There has to be a balance between the council doing proactive checks and things like that. But also, I think it's positive that we can report things. You know, we've got the technology to be able to report those things quickly. But you're right, it's absolutely frustrating when they're not getting done. What that's showing, actually, is that the cuts that have been made to local government budgets over the last 5 years are biting now. The mayor will tell you that all of his budget cuts and changes aren't having a negative impact on services. He said that at full council a couple of months ago. The reality is that they are, and we need people to keep telling him that they are.
Well, we ain't seen nothing yet. According to George Osborne on Wednesday, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we've seen the Chancellor's autumn statement headline on the same day in The Guardian. I think it was Jonathan Friedland, I'm not sure. He was saying that we're going back to the 1930s. That is to say things like even less than half the amount of spending on statutory services like the police, this kind of thing.
Well, I think it's fairly clear that George Osborne is taking an ideological approach to his brief, and it's no secret that people on the right of the Tory party, like the local MP Chris Skidmore or Jack Lopresti, they would like to see a state similar to the size that we see in the United States or to Britain in the 1930s, and they're using the crisis in the economy and in the financial services sector to achieve their political goal. I think he's rather scored an own goal with that, because I don't think that was quite the impression he wanted the rest of the population to get.
So what are your take-homes from the autumn statement this year? I noticed there's a few things. Devolution of some powers, of taxation powers out around the country, which my immediate thought is, well, if there's problems with not getting the tax in, Osborne is washing his hands of this. And also stamp duty. This is another way, of course, to keep house prices from sinking. There's a lot of stories over the last few weeks of house prices levelling out, possibly even going down.
Well, it's a very political autumn statement rather than budget. I mean, juicing house prices. I mean, the cut in stamp duty isn't going to make houses more accessible, especially to people who can't afford to get on the housing ladder. It's probably just going to keep house prices up, or he's hoping it's going to keep house prices up through to May next year. I think the real...
Well, for the election.
For the election. It's an electioneering budget. But I think the other thing that's very clear is that his attempt to reduce the deficit in one parliament has fundamentally failed. In actual fact, he's ended up carrying out a policy very similar to the one that was recommended by Alistair Darling and then by Ed Balls. But with a lot of huffing and puffing in the interim, and of course a lot of damage to services on the way. It was never going to be feasible. The problem is, if you try and cut the budget deficits too quickly, you stall the economy, and therefore you don't even manage to cut the budget deficit. He realised that was what was happening, and he took his foot off the brake, and he was lucky that then led to some growth in the economy. It might not have done, in which case he really would have been snookered. But nevertheless, the fundamental goals of the coalition government in terms of deficit reduction have not been achieved. So I don't know why they keep banging on about, why don't we talk about the deficit? Well, let's talk about the deficit. You haven't reduced it. You've caused an awful lot of pain for very little gain.
One of the figures that was being bandied around today, I heard on the radio, was, I think it was another 200 and, well, I mean, maybe I better not give the figure. What we'll do is play a bit of audio where someone is mentioning the figure rather than me guessing away at it. But it certainly seems as if there's been an element of trust about keeping your word again. I'm just bothered that it's not just the Conservative incumbents, Osborne, people like that people don't trust Martin. I mean, you're saying he's going to fix things within one parliament. Now it looks like two, exactly as Alistair Darling was saying. Why is it that we just can't trust politicians? And I don't think this is something that's just applying to the Conservative Party. It's other parties. People want to trust what they say when they elect. They don't want to hear, at the next successive general election after that, oh, well, sorry, we might have got that a little bit wrong. We're going to make another pledge. And then, because what are we voting for if we can't trust the people that we're electing?
Well, there are two aspects to this. One is that the world is actually an incredibly complicated place at the minute, in particular, and you really cannot presume that you will know what is happening even 6 months down the line, never mind 5 years ahead. So, in other words, all of these prognostications and projections are very much dependent upon everything remaining pretty much the same as it is now, and you can pretty much guarantee that it won't. There's all sorts of black swans out there, as they say.
What are these black swans, anyway? What's that all about?
Well, the concept of a black swan, it's Matt Taibbi's concept. I mean, basically saying that most of the time things trundle along and are fairly predictable, but once in a while something comes along, a swan that is black, like when people first saw black swans in Australia, they were shocked. But I think it's a misconception, really, because black swans implies that things are basically predictable, but once in a while unpredictable things happen. I would suggest that things are basically unpredictable. So one of the problems is that people are looking for predictability from politicians, then they're looking for, you know, it's not really feasible for people to give honest answers to things that are going to be happening in 4 and 5 years' time. And the other thing is that the politicians don't really determine what goes on. The financial services sector and the banking sector and the military-industrial complex and the secret services that are employed by the military-industrial complex, they set the parameters within which elected politicians operate. And so, in actual fact, you know, you can vote for who you like, but in actual fact, there are forces bigger than the politicians which are actually
Member of the Labour Party. Why bother if, you know, the bankers and the secret services, the oil industry, etc., are calling the shots?
Because if you walk away from the political struggle, then they really will call the shots and there won't be any other option. It's not actually... My call for people to be interested and get involved in politics is not because you can change things very easily or that we can promise very much. The alternative is simply worse. And that's really the only reason why I would encourage people to vote Labour. I'm not very particularly happy with the way the Labour Party's run or the kind of ambitions that it has, which to my mind are far too limited. But on the other hand, I don't think there's really much of an option. Churchill said years ago, democracy seems like the worst possible system for running everything until you look at the alternatives.
OK, well, let's go to have a listen now to Jonathan Friedland, who was on Wednesday on 5 Live. Yes, he is from The Guardian, I thought he was. Get his take on the Chancellor's autumn statement. And he did talk here in this little excerpt about specifically about how it's going to affect local government, because there's so many things that do depend on local government, and we often tend to forget them.
He's suggesting such a shrinkage of the state that, as we've said in our paper today, about 1930s levels, that even, you know, the IFS, the Independent Institute of Fiscal Studies, has said that in the unprotected departments, police, justice, and crucially, and always overlooked, local government, which people think are just two boring words, but actually mean the councils that clean the bins off the streets and provide care for the disabled and often for the elderly and others, those cuts will go from what they have been, which is roughly £3,000 per head for every person per year, down to 1,300, less than half.
So I'm also joined by Sam Mungan, who's a Labour councillor. Sam, if we're getting half as much spending on some of these essential services from local authorities as a result of what's being spelt out here in the autumn statement, what is the point in paying our tax if we're getting less and less for it all the time?
Our tax is that we're all contributing to the services that we're receiving. At the moment, you know, that's being attacked at a national level in terms of cuts to local government from the tax we're paying into the Exchequer. But in terms of, you know, the council tax that we pay on, you know, each year straight to Bristol City Council, you know, that's going directly onto the services that we need. So, you know, actually what we need to do is making sure that the people who aren't paying their tax, which is mainly corporations who are avoiding tax by putting their assets into foreign countries like Luxembourg, we need to make sure that actually they're contributing, because they get the benefits of council spending as well, from the roads, from the education that we get in schools, and from the care that we provide for society at large.
But, I mean, the council tax is a regressive tax. It hits the poor much harder than it hits the rich. You know, for example, if you're on a living wage or a minimum wage, maybe not so much the living wage, but if you're on low wages, quite often the council tax is a massive slice of your disposable income. For most people, you know, sort of reasonable middle incomes or above, it's peanuts. So why on earth insist on that as a tax, which if you don't pay it, you go to jail, apparently, whereas the big corporations, who've got lots of money, they're shifting it around the world, are scot-free. They don't go to jail for that, do they?
They don't. I mean, the thing about council tax is, you're right, it's long overdue in terms of reform. You know, it should be a fairer tax. But actually, you know, we need to get more income from those tax that are proportionate, in terms of, you know, increasing the higher rate of tax for people who are earning over £150,000, for things like introducing a mansion tax for people with extremely expensive homes. Those are things we should be focusing on, those things that the Labour government would, rather than the Conservative government, which is cutting tax rates at those higher ends. And for instance, you know, the stamp duty, which actually, again, which was a regressive tax, I think it's quite right to reform that as a tax so it's fairer. But actually, I don't see why that's been cut at all, overall, income stream, because that's benefiting people who can afford to buy homes rather than the vast majority of people, particularly young people these days, who can't afford to buy homes.
Well, one of the points that was being made by Jonathan Friedland, I rather loved, I haven't listened to this, was that Labour seemed to be saying, well, we've got to be strict too. There's no even conception that maybe that there should be taxing more.
You've got a curious thing here of where Labour feels they've got to be careful not to say something that is a bit too palatable, that they feel they've got to sound hair-shirt and strict and rigorous and austere, because if they actually, what some of them say privately is more on the lines I was saying, that this is a kind of self-harm to an economy, to keep shrinking it, but they feel now that and this is a great success of Osborne's, that the competition is to seem strictest. They could easily point to George Osborne and say, The recovery, such as it is, that we've got in this country came when he took his foot off the throat of the economy. It's when he actually eased up and stopped the cuts and stopped obsessing about getting the deficit down in time, and in fact adopted, in effect, the Darling timetable. It's when he did that that the economy picked up a bit. And you didn't have to be any expert. The economy was already picking up in 2010 in those last quarters of the Gordon Brown period. It was picking up and then got choked off again once austerity started.
Well, I think that point, the point was being very well made there by Jonathan Friedland. In actual fact, the economy, insofar as it has picked up, is because the deficit has been allowed to slide a little. I think the problem for all Labour governments going back to the 1920s is that they are presumed to be profligate. The same with the Democrats in the US. But in actual fact, often they've been more austere than their right-wing opponents. But of course, the propaganda from the mainstream media, particularly the sort of influential media like Financial Times and The Economist and so on, is that, you can't trust Labour with spending. And of course, Labour politicians, whatever their views, have to work within a kind of universe of narrative which has been created by the powers that be.
Well, you say the powers that be, I say Bilderberg, because Ed Balls is a member of this Bilderberg organisation, which is really very secretive, started by a former SS officer at the end of Second World War, in fact in the 1950s, and he sits in these meetings with George Osborne, secret meetings every year, and he's given his lecture by the global financial elite.
Well, what happens with the Labour Party is that it is, in fact, what makes it a useful vehicle for social change is that it's got one foot inside the establishment and one foot outside the establishment. So, as you know, Tony, we went to the Bilderberg conference last year. Was it the year before?
In Watford.
And both Ed Balls and Peter Mandelson were inside the building talking with the corporate elite, and Michael Meacher, who was the only elected politician, on the outside with the protesters. And he, in fact, Michael Meacher then brought forward a early day motion into the House of Commons demanding a report back from those who'd been in the meeting about what was discussed. He didn't get very far with that, but he did in fact get a debate in Parliament about it. Now that to me shows pretty much in a snapshot what the Labour Party is all about. And what I think Balls and Mandelson should have done, having gone into the meeting, is just come out and have a little chat with the protesters. What people worry about these things, if people go into these meetings and they won't say what's going on behind those closed doors, well, bound to create suspicion.
Effectively, they're swearing secrecy, including people like Marcus Agius from the executive board of the BBC goes in there. He's not reporting about it on the BBC. He's keeping shtum.
Yes.
Anyway, don't you think that this is one of the reasons why people are a little bit disillusioned with voting, Sam, that they feel that the actual economic policies, which, let's face it, this is one of the key things that the government's about. We pay our tax in. We trust them to spend it on the things to make society better. But it seems more and more of it is simply going on repaying unpayable debts.
Well, the debts are there. They need to be paid down to, actually stop them from becoming more expensive.
Well, hang on a minute, because you're never going to pay them off. The debt is growing all the time, and we're hearing now projections up to, if Osborne gets his way, we're talking about $2 trillion national debt. Almost all the activity of the country, it seems, and the tax that's gathered by the government is just simply going to be going to paying interest on that debt, not to pay off the debt, just to pay the interest.
Well, the important thing actually is how you're paying for that debt and how you're paying for that interest of debt. And we believe in making sure those people who can afford to pay are paying the most. And you don't pay that debt down by cutting services that are essential for people, who can't afford to be buying houses. People who are on a minimum wage.
Well, they can't afford rent often. People just scrabbling together to pay the rent. And in fact, sometimes they say they miss a payment on a rent or a mortgage or whatever, and they're told, right, if you don't pay up the next week, you're out.
Yeah, absolutely. And, that's a growing issue across the country. That actually shows why this government's got its priorities wrong, when it's actually supporting a tax cut for homeowners when there are people being made homeless because they can't afford to rent a home. We'd like to see more protection for people who are renting in terms of protected tenancies, in terms of fixed rents. And we'd also like to see a massive build in terms of houses, and particularly affordable and social houses.
Well, this whole business of living standards, it's going down and down, folks, but it was discussed at Prime Minister's Questions this week, which is a particularly rowdy one, I think, because of the autumn statement. But bear with us, because here is the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, asking the Prime Minister, David Cameron, about this whole business of living standards.
What he ought to be saying, but don't, is that he made a solemn promise of no top-down reorganisation of the NHS, and he broke that promise. Let's turn to his promise on living standards. The 2010 Conservative Manifesto made this big promise, and I quote, "An economy where standards of living rise steadily." Mr. Speaker, when he said it, did he mean it?
Yes, I meant it. And 26 million people having their taxes cut. 3 million people. 26 million people have had their taxes cut. 3 million of the poorest people have been taken out of income tax altogether. The minimum wage has been increased for the first time since his Great Recession. And now people who've been in work for a year are seeing a 4% increase in their pay. They bankrupted our economy. We know that Mrs. Brown's Boys was a comedy. Mr. Brown's Boys was a tragedy.
Well, actually, Tony, I think one of the great failings of this so-called economic recovery in terms of actually how it's affecting living standards, our economy is growing, but we're not actually feeling that in our wallets. Actually, in terms of tax rises, wage stagflation and increasing prices, actually, most families are about an average of £1,000 worse off now than they were 4 or 5 years ago. What we need to now see is actually the profits from this economic recovery, so-called economic recovery, shared with the people who actually need it and who've suffered over the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, David Cameron there is saying that this is actually the legacy that they've had to deal with, because, I suppose, mainly the terms of the bailout that Gordon Brown arranged in 2008, which meant something like £700 billion of our money was given to the banks in order to keep them afloat.
Well, as Martin said earlier, actually, you know, the policies that this government have pursued in terms of trying to pay down a debt have failed. So actually what we've done is, you know, is cut services, cut the benefits working people are receiving, and let the economy at the same time suffer and go back into a recession after this government got into power. And we're only just seeing the economy starting to recover now. But that needs to now be shared across the country and across society. And, you know, the autumn statement and the budget that the Chancellor's putting forward won't do that.
Let's move on to discuss some other things. Transport. Rail fares have gone up massively yesterday again. And first buses fares gone up something like 10%, just like that. You know, I don't know why, how they pick this figure of 10%. You know, a fare which is £4 is suddenly becomes £4.40. It's just like they're taking the mickey, really. First bus, by the way, and the people that First Great Western, that have the franchise to London, apart of this organisation First Group, which is a US company, which has massive, massive debts. Go online, folks, and have a look at the massive debt they've got. So basically, when we're paying our extra increase on the bus fare or on the train fare to London and back, what we'll find is that all that money is simply yet again going to pay interest. Martin, how on earth can the ordinary commuters, people out there now maybe sitting on the bus listening on their Walkman or whatever they have these days, an MP3 type thing on their phone, you know, these increases aren't actually delivering any kind of improvement in service, and pay is not going up to meet them.
Well, that's right. I mean, I dare I mention the fact that these industries used to be in public ownership. And, of course, what's happened with the East Coast Main Line is that they're not going to allow the public sector to continue to run it at a profit.
Well, they've been doing very well, haven't they?
As we've successfully been doing. And I'm afraid a new Labour government coming to power next year will not probably reverse all of these changes over the last 20 or 30 years. But, of course, it is the privatisation of the infrastructure of the country and the deregulation of the financial markets, which is the cause of the crash, which the Prime Minister was talking about.
It almost sounds to
me
a bit like a kind of feudal system where you've got a kind of king.
It is.
The Prime Minister is the king. He sees these nice little earners as part of the national infrastructure, and he just dishes them out to his favourite barons.
Well, that's right. That's exactly what's happened, and I'm afraid a Labour government... I'll put a caveat on that. A Labour government coming to power, as long as the recovery continues, will not do anything to jeopardise that recovery and is unlikely to reverse these rather negative changes that have happened in the last 20 or 30 years. But of course, if there is a further crash, and that could very definitely happen either before or after next May, then of course more radical solutions will have to be considered.
Martin's right that the, you know, Labour Party isn't looking to renationalise the rail service or the bus service, but actually what it has said is that it will give powers to cities like Bristol to make a decision about whether actually there are better models for provision of public transport in the city than this monopoly that First have at the moment in our city. And that could include actually having a publicly run bus service or train service within the city, which I'd much rather see in terms of, like you said, the money that we're paying for our fares going back and invested into local infrastructure that we need.
On to another story now, and secret malware in European Union attack was linked to US and British intelligence. Well, we're always being told, aren't we, oh, the Chinese are hacking our computers. Or according to Glenn Greenwald at the website The Intercept, which I thoroughly recommend, you can follow him on Twitter, etc., or whatever you want to do, but it's the website's firstlook.org/theintercept. firstlook.org/theintercept, and on there you'll find all the stuff that used to be in the Guardian until the Guardian and Glenn Greenwald amicably fell out, and the Guardian stopped publishing these Snowden revelations. This is one of the latest ones. Complex malware known as Regin, is the suspected technology behind sophisticated cyber attacks conducted by US and British intelligence agency on the European Union and a Belgian telecommunications company, according to security industry sources and technical analysts conducted by The Intercept. Regin was found on infected internal computer systems and email servers at Belgacom, partly state-owned Belgian phone and internet provider. Following reports last year, the company was targeted in a top-secret surveillance operation. Now, I'll come to you first on this, Martin, because this is an interesting one, I think. We've heard a lot, haven't we, about the way that the National Security Agency and GCHQ in Cheltenham, the spooks, the transatlantic spooks, do deal quite a lot with these big telecommunications firms. The telecommunications firms, then some of them will say, yes, we'll secretly cooperate with you and do whatever you want us to do. Others of them, it seems like Belgicom or Belgacom, say, actually, no, we want to protect the rights of our users. And if they do, it seems they're going to get hacked and they're going to get malware stuck on their systems.
Well, I'll just make the point that if there is no legal basis for this, and there doesn't appear to be, if the Chinese have been doing it, as you say, it would be regarded as criminal behaviour, then it's criminal behaviour. And I'm afraid the GCHQ NSA, as part of the military-industrial complex, are patently out of control. And a future Labour government will have to consider very carefully what sort of legislation is going to be required to put these people back
in
the
box. Well, you say out of control, but surely this is somebody is controlling them. Someone's telling them, we want to get access to all of these telecommunications
networks. It's out of control
networks.
In the sense that these kind of interceptions and downloadings of malware are illegal existing law.
Okay, so that's interesting. Maybe the police should be down at Cheltenham if they would be allowed in. I'm not sure if they'd be let through the security. I'm not sure. But who is controlling them?
Well, that's a question, isn't it? We mentioned the bankers earlier. There is a financial military industrial complex in the West which is clearly calling the shots. Once elected governments decided to bail out the financial services sector in 2008, it became clear that we've moved into a crony capitalist universe where, in fact, the market doesn't operate and that governments are subverted by powerful vested interests. And of course the vested interests also exist in things like military procurement and so on. It's a real challenge for democratic politics to get these things under control. We're nowhere near doing it yet, but we shouldn't give up the fight just because it seems a difficult one.
Okay, where are the pinch points here? Which parts of the British state should be accountable
and
armed?
The obvious pinch points are when people are carrying out blatantly illegal activities for which they have no legal basis. When we send people to prison during a riot for stealing a bottle of water for 2 years, what do we do when we find out that senior officials have been carrying out completely illegal activities for decades?
But if someone's doing something illegal, in order to take them to court, you need evidence. You're not going to get evidence by knocking on the door at GCHQ, are you?
Well, the evidence has appeared that one of the things about these kind of cyber attacks and so on is that evidence is, in fact, created by the attack itself. It's a question of whether the police have the will and the independence to act.
Well, they were well known in World War II, Bletchley Park, for managing to, I suppose they didn't call it hacking in those days, but to get into the German Nazi Enigma codes.
Yes, but
how has it come round to this, where actually what they seem to be doing is targeting our own personal communications?
Well, that's quite right.
Treating us like they treated the Nazis.
What's quite interesting about the way things have developed is that the Russian intelligence services seem to be very good at taking out telephone conversations of an extremely sensitive nature. So, for example, the discussion between Catherine Ashton and Umas Piets, the Estonian foreign minister, about the shootings in Maidan Square beginning of the year, pointing the finger at the current regime, the Pravi sector, Andrei Paribia. So the Russians...
You mean talking about responsibility for the Ukrainian coup in February?
Yes, but the point is that the Russians actually are targeting very important politically sensitive conversations and then leaking them to the international press. What the Western intelligence services are doing is listening to everybody's communications and then using algorithms to try and analyse the behaviour of the population in order to try and control the population at large. That's a big difference. It's a difference in philosophy as well as a difference in activity. And I think that the you can see where this is going, because the things like Facebook do allow intelligence services to build a profile of the whole population and of its likes, dislikes, how's it taking the budget, for example. No, that they can find out what people are saying on their Facebook pages and so on. Whereas traditional spying was bugging the telephone of individual politicians, military targets, and so on, and finding out what individual information they held. This phishing expedition expedition style listening is very pernicious and basically illegal.
Okay, well, I feel like it's the same sort of situation as with the banks. You know, you do wonder, when did money stop becoming a useful tool to help the population and to help society, and start becoming you know, this intractable debt dragging society down? In the same way, with the security services, the spooks listening into conversations, starting off in World War II with hacking into what the Nazis were up to, and now hacking into our lives. And of course, we've got also the police, the Metropolitan Police, infiltrating environmental groups, hacking their lives, who've done nothing wrong, done nothing criminal at all, even having children with them.
Well, yes, and also there's a suggestion that all of those kind of activities were illegal. I mean, ultimately, there's got to be a rule of law, and that rule of law has to apply to the head of MI5, the head of MI6, and the Prime Minister. So, for example, it's possible that that David Cameron signed off on an armed uprising in Syria. That is what the French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, suggested on French television a couple of years ago. Now, if we were thinking of putting President Assad on trial for starting the war in Syria, and it turns out that MI6, on the say-so of David Cameron, started the war in Syria, perhaps David Cameron shouldn't be worrying about losing the next election. He should be worrying about having his collar felt.
Well, we started with Edward Snowden there. What are your thoughts about the revelations that have come out and how it affects you, I suppose, as a politician in the city here, and the population more generally?
Well, I think what's interesting, I suppose, from what Martin was saying, in terms of there is obviously a difference between a philosophy between countries like Russia and countries like ours in terms of where we see the threat coming from. Russia, you know, has an opinion that, you know, states and other countries are the threat to their security, whereas our state government believes that it's individuals because of our experience with terrorism over the last 50 years. So what I would say is that in terms of security, you know, the state does have a duty to make sure that our citizens are safe, and intelligence gathering plays a part in that. But what I would like to see, actually, is much more openness and transparency in terms of how that's done and how people are targeted and the type of information that's available. What Edward Snowden has actually done is reveal that how that's gathered and actually who's involved in that, and how, you know, companies like big internet firms and internet providers are involved in that. Actually, that's something our government should be telling us. And, you know, if we want to have a secure state and we want people to buy into the fact that we need to have some sort of intelligence gathering, they need to be open and honest with us about how it's done and accountable democratically for that as well.
But the spooks will say, no way, we can't be accountable because it's all secret.
Well, there's a difference between releasing everything in terms of all the information they're gathering and actually talk and describing actually how it's done, because, you know, actually, you know, these things are found anyway. As Martin said, they leave a trace when they're done, and, you know, the world we live in a globalised, intelligent world with lots of information out there, it will be found. So why not be open and transparent in the first place?
Okay. Back to the House of Commons now, and Dennis Skinner with his figure. It was actually $430 billion, and that's the increase in debt. It looks like we're heading for $2 trillion of national debt. But anyway, here's Dennis Skinner this week at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Mr. Dennis Skinner.
Is the Prime Minister proud of the fact that in this Parliament, this government has added $430 billion to the national debt, which is more than all the Labour chancellors of the Exchequer this century? He can't blame Labour for that figure.
Oh, yes, I can. We inherited the biggest budget deficit in Britain's peacetime history. The Labour Party had the longest and deepest recession in a century. That is what we were delivered. Since then, we've turned the economy around, we've got 2 million private sector jobs, we've cut the deficit, 760,000 more businesses are operating in our country, and we have the fastest growing economy of any G7 or major European country. That is an economic record that no Labour government could ever match.
Well, that's the panto season has arrived when we hear these kind of exchanges, haven't we? Oh, no, he isn't. Oh, yes, he is. The fact is that the national debt has been rising dramatically because of the global economic crisis. And you can't reduce your debt in the middle of a crisis very easily. You can pretend you can perhaps reduce the deficit, but even that's not clear, because attempts to reduce the deficit sometimes cause the economy to slow, which means that you then defeat the object of the exercise. So there are two levels of this. There's one is how are we driving the car? Are we driving the car in jerks and bumps, which I would argue that the coalition have been doing, instead of smoothly changing gear as Labour might have done? But the other problem is the car itself. The international financial system is, I'm afraid, beyond its sell-by date completely. And it's not a question of governments in Britain and what they would or wouldn't like to do. I fear very much that we are going to have another global crash. The Federal Reserve in the US has stopped its...
Hang on. Crash? It wasn't a crash. It was a financial crisis. In fact, the bailout stopped it being a crash, didn't it?
Well, it did. It did, because if the state hadn't stepped in, or states around the world hadn't stepped in, led by our Prime Minister Gordon Brown,
who saved the world, as he
famously said. But of course, all that was doing really was putting a sticking plaster over a gaping wound. And I think one of the problems for the Labour government was that it was very hard to turn round to the population and say, look, we've saved the world, because what they should have been doing in 13 years in power is reforming the regulation of the City of London. They chose not to do that. That was a definite choice by the Labour government, not to take the city on. Not that Cameron or any Tories were calling for that. And then, of course, you're caught in the double bind, which is we didn't regulate the city, and therefore we're being blamed for that, and in a way, rightly so. But, of course, the Conservative opposition had no intention of regulating the city at all, and still don't.
Martin's absolutely right. You know, the Labour Party did make a mistake in not reforming the City of London and financial services in general. You know, we've been asked by the Conservative Party to apologise for spending too much. Actually, we shouldn't be apologising for that, but we should be apologising for not doing what we should have done with the city. And actually, the problem we've got now is that we've had, you know, 4 years or 5 years of cuts, but nothing actually to do with the underlying issues that still exist in those financial services markets.
Okay. Now, that. What about that figure, though, Sam Mungan, you're a Labour councillor for Windmill Hill, that figure we had from Dennis Skinner of £430 billion more debt. I come back to what I was saying before. This is never going to be paid off. That sort of figure is an absolute colossal amount of money. We're going to be up and over $2 trillion national debt. That's never going to be paid. All of the national activity, everything we do, every penny in tax that we pay is going to be going just to pay interest to the banks. We know about the banksters. They've done all sorts of crime up in the city, things like money laundering, LIBOR fraud, foreign exchange fraud. Oh, we're being told that the ruble apparently is going down, but how can we trust the foreign exchange markets when we know the banks have been defrauding them, with them, and none of those people have been arrested and punished for it. All that's happened is there's been nice little fines on the banks, so the individuals who've been doing these crimes have never been affected. So all I'm saying is, why are we constantly working, it seems, and paying our taxes just to pay interest on an unpayable debt?
Well, it's not a figure I've heard before from that Dennis Skinner mentioned, but I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, it's right. It's a colossal amount, and you know, it's because of the financial crisis we went through, which was a global crisis, and we will be paying off it for some time. We've only just paid off our debt from the First World War, you might have noticed this week. You know, I don't think we'd be still paying this off in 100 years, but actually, you know, we should be measured about how we're paying it off. We shouldn't be rushing to pay it off because it's a macho thing to do, and that's what George Osborne's trying to do. It's a macho, I can pay this down, and actually I can put us back into surplus, but I will do it by making the people, you know, who are most vulnerable in our society suffer the most.
I mean, Martin, aren't we all actually going to have to do what happened in Argentina in 2000, 2001, where they said, actually, no, we're not going to pay? Well, what happens when you do that?
Listen, there are two levels to this, as I've suggested earlier on. One is, how are you driving the car? In actual fact, if you try and cut debt too quickly, whatever the level, the national debt has never been paid off since the Napoleonic Wars. It carries on growing. Of course, it's been growing more in recent years than it did previously. And it's simply economic illiteracy to presume that you have to pay it off. In actual fact, the national debt is never paid off. It's rolled over, unless there is a final crisis, in which case countries default. They do. Every single country in Latin America in the 1930s defaulted on its international debt.
And what's the consequences of that?
Well, the problem with default is that you
it's
then...
It's like a domino effect, is it?
Well, it creates... It's part of a global crash. So you've then got a situation where there's no demand in the global economy, nobody's got any money, etc., etc. But default is a perfectly rational strategy. I mean, I would argue that Greece should have defaulted a few years ago, or even now. But, of course, a Greek default would set off a chain reaction in the system, which would probably bring down the financial markets. And from the Greeks' point of view, I think Syriza, if they win the election in Greece, that's probably what they're going to say. If you don't treat us nicely, we're just not going to pay at all. And, of course, there is nothing that says that you should pay your debts. When people lend, banks lend money to governments or to other people, they are paid interest on that debt to cover the risk that they won't be paid at all. And in actual fact, you can cancel debts. Countries do and have cancelled debts. Egypt had half of its national debt cancelled in the run-up to the first Gulf War in order to sweeten up the military government there. And the Poles had half of their national debt cancelled in 1990 in order to encourage them to adopt Thatcherite economic reforms. And if therefore debt can be cancelled when people want to cancel it. But also, of course, what will happen eventually is a crash is a massive debt cancellation. That's the positive side of a crash. I mean, a crash is, in fact, the market solution for the debt problem. The crash wipes out the debt, but, of course, it wipes out the society that owns the debt at the same time as it does that. That's the negative side.
And Sam, I mean, the effects of this on the ground are pretty horrific. I mean, we've seen big protests going on around the country by students in London and Warwick and elsewhere about the student fees, the cuts to the education, to further education, higher education, and also, massive impact on the young people is homelessness. We've heard this week a pretty shocking figure. 1 in 5 of UK's 16 to 25-year-olds has had to sleep on floors, basically sofa surfing. I mean, this is the future. And what is your party in this city and nationally going to do to stop this? Because this is no way to treat the next generation.
I absolutely agree. It's no way to treat the next generation. I'd have to say, firstly, just to go on Martin's point, we're a long way from defaulting on our debt, yeah. I think, in this country, just to make that clear. But in terms of what George Osborne has said in his tactic in terms of trying to pay off the deficit so quickly, is that it's about a legacy for young people so that they won't be taking the burden that's been passed down from previous generation. Actually, what sort of legacy are we providing them if we're tripling tuition fees? If we've got 25% unemployment for young people and they can't get into well-paid jobs and they can't get into stable jobs and they're homeless. What the Labour Party would do, so starting with homelessness, we would build far more houses than the government is at the moment. We would protect their rights as tenants. We aren't planning on cutting their access to housing benefit, which is one of the things that David Cameron's planning on doing. We would support the economy in terms of well-paid graduate jobs rather than just quick fix jobs to get the unemployment rate down, which is what this government's done. And we would continue to invest in the education system as we had previously over the 13 years of the previous Labour government. Because actually, that's the legacy that we should be providing to young people. Forget about the debt burden. Unless they're getting a chance in terms of prosperity and opportunities within their life, they won't care about how much debt because they won't be contributing to it through their taxes.
Just a little bit of local news today from the BBC site. The police are facing misconduct charges over Bian Ibrahimi's death. Three police constables and a police community support officer are to face misconduct charges after the murder of a man by a neighbour who wrongly believed him to be a paedophile. I'm sure you'll remember this one. Lee James, 25, killed Bijan Ibrahimi and set fire to his body in the Brislington area of Bristol in 2013. PCs Kevin Duffy, Helen Harris and Leanne Winter allegedly failed to respond to the victim's calls for help. And Police Community Support Officer Andrew Passmore is alleged to have given false information to a 999 operator about his location. Mr Passmore will also be charged with perverting the course of justice for allegedly giving different accounts to the murder investigation and to the police watchdog. Pretty shocking stuff there. Anyway, just very quickly, Martin, your thoughts on whether this is going to be helping or not George Osborne, the autumn statement in the next election next May?
Hopefully not, from my point of view.
No, well, just expand on that a bit, because he's saying he's going to get it all back together. Is he?
No, I think the real problem is that nobody's telling people the truth about the really serious nature of the global financial crisis. Everybody wants to treat the electorate like toddlers.
Okay, well, thanks, Martin. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks also to this week's guest, Labour councillor for Windmill Hill, Sam Mungan. After the Murdoch News, who are the local organisations behind the TTIP treaty, which threatens to enable banks and big businesses to sue our elected governments? And is it the same people who are behind the push for an elected mayor?
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Jimmy Savile's friend and chauffeur Ray Terrett has been found guilty of 7 rapes and 11 indecent assaults against girls. Claire Gregory reports.
Ray Terrett is a devious, manipulative sexual predator.
That's Detective Sergeant Carol Barlow from Greater Manchester Police speaking about Ray Terrett, the DJ who groomed and attacked young girls during the 1960s and 1970s. Nazir Afzal from the Crown Prosecution Service paid tribute to his victims.
Collective courage has ensured that Ray Terrett has been brought to justice today.
One victim spoke about how he treated her.
I didn't have a clue about how he'd taken advantage of my vulnerability.
Terrett will be sentenced next week.
Two men who travelled to Syria last year to join a terrorist group have both been jailed for almost 13 years. Friends Mohammed Ahmed and Yusuf Sarwar, both aged 22 and from Birmingham, were arrested on terror charges on their arrival back in the UK. Detective Chief Inspector Sue Southern is from West Midlands Counter-Terrorism Unit.
They made certain life choices. They deceived their family, they did a certain amount of preparatory work, there was clearly an element of radicalisation. So, you know, we're not dealing with two individuals that went as tourists and then found themselves wrapped up in something they didn't understand.
A serious case review is expected into the deaths of a mother and her newborn baby who went missing from a maternity hospital in Bristol. The bodies of Charlotte Bevan and the four-day-old girl were found yesterday. Members of three unions are now backing strike action at police forces in England and Wales. Civilian staff are voted to walk out in a dispute over pay. In football, Wigan chairman Dave Whelan's been condemned after more questionable comments. In attempting to defend himself over previous language, the British Chinese project has criticised him for more highly offensive words. And a spaceship designed to one day fly astronauts to Mars has completed a flawless test flight around the Earth. NASA's touchdown safely in the Pacific. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station. I feel a small voice.